Remember, we have live mics, so nobody pull a Peggy Noonan over here.
Hello, and welcome to the PC Gamer Podcast. On today's podcast, Chavat Rock with Chavat Yerli, CEO of Crytek and the man behind Crisis Warhead, plus the Gamer's Bill of Rights, Evan and Andy Storm PAX, and a number of gratuitous pop culture references on this episode number 147 of the PC Gamer Podcast for September 4th, 2008. Joining us today on the PC Gamer Podcast, Chavat Yerli, CEO of Crytek and one of the founding members of the studio that came out of nowhere to blow away gamers with a groundbreaking Far Cry in 2004 and then raised the bar on visual and physical realism in Crysis 3 years later. One of only three games to earn the highest rating ever awarded in our magazine at 98%. Now Crytek's about to roll out Crysis Warhead, which follows the British SAS soldier Sykes, affectionately known as Psycho. Try saying that three times fast. In a storyline that's parallel to the one we played in the original Crysis. So, Chavat, it seems significant to me that we never saw Nomad throughout Crysis. We never saw his face or heard his voice. But you told PC Gamer earlier this year that we will see and hear Psycho as we play through Crysis Warhead. So why the shift from a kind of abstract hero to a specific character?
Okay, so first of all, with Crysis, the original idea was to have the player identify with the hero as much as he can. And the focus of Crysis was the nanosuit. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So we wanted to make sure the people do not get confused with who is the hero, what kind of story does he travel through, etc., but rather actually focus on the nanosuit and learn to work with it, learn to play around with it and enjoy it as much as we can, mm-hmm. so that he develops a certain mastering experience on the nanosuit. And with Warhead, however, we listened to some of the critique, which gamers wanted to have a hero, they wanted to have somebody to follow. But now that they mastered the nanosuit, I thought it's a good opportunity now to give them the nanosuit with a face this time. Mm-hmm. And we were thinking, which face can we give the player? And we picked Sykes finally.
Great. When you when you were watching people play Crysis, did you feel like not everybody really took advantage of all the suit's capabilities?
Well, there are different type of players, actually. There's a player that tries to like kill every hero or every enemy like silently and like surgically, almost like a surgery. And then there's guys who run and gun more, and when they fail, they restart and run and gun again. And there's other people who just try to be more like trying to get maximum efficiency in the playfield, not necessarily tactical and silent, but just kill everybody as fast as you can or kill everybody with minimum hits. And the nanosuit offers you actually to realize to your potential as a player in a way that you can express yourself better than in previous shooters by going with maximum strength, speed, and armor and cloak. You can actually, with those four modes, you can express your desired play style. And it's true that a lot of people do not explore all the areas because they don't like old areas, mm-hmm. but I think that I'm quite happy actually with the amount of mileage we got from the nanosuit. But then again, it would be great if people would explore all the modes because they would get much more return for their dollars, you know.
Sure. What kind of player are you?
Well, I'm the guy who actually is more the stealth guy who's taking the covers and tries to be not seen, not very silent, and takes the enemy out one by one and make sure when he takes an enemy out that he's not seen again and continues that path. Of course, when I play a level, like a level that takes averagely 40 minutes, in my case, can take 2 hours.
So if you're playing against Chavat in multiplayer, keep that in mind. Yeah, check the brush. So beyond, you know, obviously delivering an entertaining game, if the goal of Crysis had been to push the limits of gaming graphics and what we believed could have been done, what was the goal then of Crysis Warhead?
And Crisis Warhead was to get the excellence of Crisis, and actually, albeit a little bit more, actually, the graphics of Crisis, get that, but get that out to the mainstream.
Great.
So it was effectively a slightly better look of Crisis, effectively Crisis on steroids, if you want, but get this Crisis out to the maximum amount of people. That means that we wanted to make sure that the engine gets as optimized as possible. It can run on a $600 PC. It runs. It can scale to maximum for more people than at Crysis. When people bought Crysis, not a lot of people could scale it up to maximum settings. With Crysis Warhead, we want to make sure that the mainstream and the most gamers in the world, they can actually scale up the graphics, and hence they can focus and experience the gameplay. We also wanted to make sure the price tag of Warhead comes cheaper as a bargain. And comes as in form of a great deal. It's not an optimization on our side. It's more convincing EA to do that. But our goal with Warhead was to get at a bargain price, get the excellence of Crysis out to a mainstream audience.
I've read interviews with you where you talk about a lot of the games that you've enjoyed and admired, including Call of Duty 4 and Assassin's Creed. Has any other developer done something that made you just slap your forehead and think, damn, why didn't we think of that?
Recently, you mean?
Yeah, sure.
Actually, I have to say that Dead for a Life actually is a quite interesting concept. And initially, it was one of those concepts which initially didn't ring a bell with me instantly. Mm-hmm. And but later I said, damn, we could have thought about this idea.
Yeah.
And it was definitely a good one. I think it will inspire a lot of people.
And
the principle idea, I mean, sorry, I didn't play it, Dead for Life, or I didn't see it actually running, but I've read interviews or saw videos. From that, what I can gauge there, it sounds like a great concept, and it sounds like a ton of fun. Even so, the focus of that game is a bit different than we would have, like we are doing with our games. I think from the fun perspective, it's definitely going to work out.
Great. For listeners, that's he's referring to what's Left 4 Dead here in America.
Sorry, Left 4 Dead.
No problem.
Yeah.
One thing I thought worked really, really well in Crysis, but didn't get a whole lot of attention, was the dynamic music system that you know that cues up music contextually. That's part of the Cry Engine, isn't it?
Yes, yes.
So if a developer licenses the Cry Engine, it would have access to the technology that cues that music.
Yes, exactly.
How many people work on just the sound and sound effects alone at Crytek? Is that all done in-house?
In-house and outsourcing, actually. We have in-house quite a team, actually, on working on it. It's, I would have to count. I am not good with this kind of questions.
Sure, no problem.
It's, I think a handful of people are working on the sound technology and assets in-house. Mm-hmm. But then we have another studio that provides us sound assets and another composer that works with us on the music side. That has been on Crysis case. And now for the future projects, we are working in a similar constellation with more people, however.
So a while back, it was, I believe, in 2007, when Germany was considering passing a particularly strict law against violent games, you threatened to hike it out of town if it were passed. So if a law were passed that banned guns and violence in games everywhere in the world, would you still want to make them?
Well, just to be sure, the law that was in question back then wasn't about forbidding weapons or violence in games. It was actually a bit harsher. The discussion we had was forbidding the development in Germany of such games.
Yes.
And forbidding the development naturally would pose a question on us. Can a developer, like, would effectively Crytek, can Crytek operate in Germany making first-person shooters? Mm-hmm. And if the law would forbid us to do that, it would be prohibitive to us. In that case, we said we would leave the country instead of changing our concepts.
Sure.
Because or to restrict the development of that games, such games would be quite impactful for our business strategy. Would games be banned? I guess your question is if worldwide the games would be not allowed to have any guns and violence. Mm-hmm. Would we change the concepts? Yes, for sure, because we are by definition game developers, and we want to make fun entertainment products. And if the entire world cannot make any more games with guns and violence and as ingredient parts, then we would make other fun and entertainment games.
What kind of game do you think you might make?
Well, I guess to begin with, probably role play games more in that
Sure.
regards, and maybe puzzle games.
Oh yeah. Is there any puzzle game that you play all the time?
Actually, I've been playing Portal quite much.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, and I thought it's definitely an interesting game too. And it's not be I'm not playing recently. Like the last 6 months, I've not been playing a lot. But if I played, it was actually Portal.
Great. When you announced that Crytek would no longer be developing PC exclusive games after Crisis Warhead, many gamers interpreted your stance as a kind of repudiation of the PC as a gaming platform. Do you think that's an overreaction?
It's an overreaction, I think, because I mean, not developing PC exclusive doesn't mean not developing PC. We
Sure.
will still have PC games for sure, and we'll still make sure that our games are optimizing to the PC, and they're using the user interface benefits, all the other gamer benefits that people have on PC platform. We'll make sure that the PC gaming is as excellent as it can get. It just means that we won't do it exclusively anymore, because it just becomes prohibitively expensive. And I was hoping on a different return on the fact that we bet on PC exclusivity, but the return didn't get as much as we wanted, and so we cannot afford to become PC exclusive anymore.
Okay. One of the biggest concerns our readers and listeners have is whether or not Crytek will be developing with consoles and in all their attendant limitations in mind first and foremost.
I don't think so. I mean, from what I'm looking at the current developments here already, we always make sure that the PC gamer is still at the equivalent priority. But it does mean though that their priorities have to be split. And however, it's not that like PC gets a priority or console gets a priority. It's just that PC has to be fun and console has to be fun, and all have to be evaluated.
Sure. You had mentioned before that I think Crysis has sold something like 1.5 million copies,
Yeah, about that.
and that you had mentioned that you believe that the ratio of sold to pirated copies could have been as high as 1 to 20. Now, do you really think that 30 million copies of Crysis have been pirated?
Well, the thing is, we have statistics of key registrations and online registration, online trials that are from unique identities. If you calculate that up, plus if we get all the data we have in terms of how many people try to register, how many people try to go online, unique identities, that means that there's about 25 to 30 million floating copies around, or Crysis. And it means there is a popularity of Crysis out there that didn't work well in the economics. But I'm actually happy about the fact that there are 25 million potential copies out there playing Crysis. It's not a bad achievement too. Because the people have been saying that I'm bitching about the piracy and whatnot. I'm not bitching about the piracy, actually. What I'm doing is the fact that the economics are the fact that piracy harms economics is not a new story. It has been the music, it has been the movies, and it's in the PC industry for a long time now. Fact is, it did harm us, and we made a consequence out of it, saying we will make a multi-platform development. But at the same time, I'm actually happy there's a lot of piracy out there, because the fact is that the IP is very popular, and it's a very strong brand. From that perspective, it's not a bad thing too, I always see
Sure.
to try to see things positive, not negative.
Yeah, absolutely. So, despite all the innovation, the progress, and all the money being made in the PC gaming industry, particularly with massively multiplayer games, there's still a
Exactly.
perception of a platform that's not as attractive to developers as the consoles.
No, yes.
So we've got this PC Gaming Alliance that's trying to, reverse that perception. What's the first thing you would do if you were the head of, say, the PC Gaming Alliance? How would you elevate the PC gaming industry in order to battle this perception?
I think,
That's a tough one.
yeah, sorry.
No, please, go ahead.
Yeah, I think the principal question to some degree is about right management, digital right management. I think if you look really at the difference between online games on PC, offline games on PC, and console games, it's really about digital right management. And if you look at online PC games that are successful, that are on the increasing train to success, or on the trend of increasing revenues and market shares, if you look at that charts, and you see that these are the games that have actually a clear identity or clear digital right management scheme in one way or another, whether it's online subscriptions, whether it's different ways to that, right? And so, and offline games, they suffer from this because they are, again, pirated and easier. And on the consoles, piracy is less of an issue as well because of a protected environment, and people accept the fact that they have to pay for effectively a digital right management system, which is either the PlayStation 3 or the Xbox Live or Xbox 360, and with that, buying protected content that is quality proven or quality tested, or how do you say, quality approved by the first party holders. People are happy to actually, the mainstream consumers are easier happy to buy originals because of the fact of Xbox Live or PSN connectivity now. And so the fact that online helps sales is something that in principle will affect our strategy. And I would think the PC Gaming Alliance should focus around this, how the experience of the user on the PC and online can actually be more, even more mainstreamed, or online DRM solutions can be accepted as a standard by a committee of PC Gaming Alliance and maybe users that approve that kind of standards, that offline games can benefit from that too, as an online DRM systems. And then actually, is, I think even the offline games on PC, the traditional offline games on PC with an online DRM would actually receive a significant sales boost.
Great. You know, there are some people that are saying, like, I'm thinking particularly of Stardock here, who are saying that the answer isn't DRM at all. In fact, they're saying get rid of the DRM, blow away that whole layer that it sits between the gamer and the developer, and instead focus on widening the market by keeping your system requirements to an absolute minimum. What do you think about that response to piracy?
Well, the thing is, for example, with Crysis, if you see, there are people who are playing Crysis, a lot of people who are trying to play Crysis or registering online, etc. And first of all, our copy protection wasn't the best one, yeah, so it was quite quickly hacked. So from that perspective, 20 to 25 or millions people by today's standards have access to Crysis, so there's already a mass market or massive amount of users actually playing Crysis. So it's not really a matter of system requirements. From that perspective, it's not or cannot, because there's a lot of people trying to play or playing. Yeah? And I think DRM is an issue still, but I think there's another answer to it too. Instead of DRM, you can of course do it like some other games has been trying to do with digital downloadable content, or with microtransaction systems, with new business models. I mean, I'm not mentioning anything new. There has been some of this has been tried and actually successfully run as a business in Asia for many years now already. In Asia, I think that the PC market and piracy, if you look at the piracy, it's quite pretty much non-existent on online games, and they're covering online games that we would actually not call online games, like online shooters, online racing games, online action RPGs, but they're like small-scale online games that are not massive multiplayer online, but just online. They're connected. And from that perspective, I think online DRM is not the only solution. Definitely, DRM is one of the solution, but DRM is the good thing about DRM is it is not concept dependent. You can apply an online DRM solution to any game, right? But a concept that requires microtransactions or community building or etc. online connectivity, that requires concept changes, concept modifications, and not all games apply to that rules. So there are alternative ways. But I would never think of getting rid of the RAM and just hope with my no system requirements I get enough critical mass to buy the game.
Sure.
This would be too much of a risk.
Yeah, absolutely. So to get back to Crisis Warhead, you brought in Susan O'Connor, who had worked on Gears of War and BioShock.
Yes.
Why did you turn to her for this next part of the story when, you had a you, whoever wrote, who did the original story for Crisis? Was that done in-house?
Yeah, it was in-house and contractors. We worked with a few actually, and then in-house we rework again, and this was quite a mess to develop. But so you cannot paint one name really on the story of Crisis. And that actually, frankly, was one of the reasons why I wanted to work with somebody that has a bit of a credentials in the industry of AAA titles. And Susan, we met Susan at the GDC. I think this was, this year, GDC actually, wasn't that far away. Time passes too fast for me. So it was just GDC this year, and we met, we said, look, we have a script here in front of us for Warhead. We have characters to then fleshed out, and then she worked with a team, and that was pretty much a no-brainer.
Great.
I mean, quite simple job.
So if you if so if somebody has played through Crisis, they loved it, but they're wondering what's coming up in Warhead that's really going to be different. Is it going to be more of the same? Because it's you know, tellingly, you're saying it's not an expansion pack. It's a continuation of the story. It's
Yes.
its own new game. So
Yes.
what's different about Warhead that'll bring people back other than just the low price?
I think Warhead has okay, if there's a low price, there's the amount of content there. But I think also from the gameplay formula, we have refined it and we made it more intense and just more action-packed. I think what there was a moment in Crisis what people resonated extremely well to, and the moment was in the level of Harbor, where you attack the first like Harbor, and at the beginning there was a script sequence of action, and then you would go to a spot where you could get an overview, the Veni Vidi Vici spot we call it, where you can observe and tactically assess the harbor, and then you go in and do the non-linear gameplay there. This piece of action formula there, what we had, we didn't repeat this formula. It was sort of like a perturbation of a core formula of Crisis, but we used it only one mission, and people resonated to this so strong that we said we could make actually this refinement of the concept we could use as a formula for Warhead itself, because every game at the end of the day, if you dissect the game, whether it's Crisis, Halo, or Quake, whatever it is, right, you can take 2 or 3 minutes, dissect it, and find a formula that works for the 5, 6, 7, 10, 12 hours if you want. And Crisis formula refined, you can find in Warhead. Warhead is sort of Crisis on steroids.
Super. And what can we expect after Warhead?
That I don't know. Well, frankly, I know, of course, but
Sure.
there's a lot of developments, nice developments going on, and I
Well,
think,
I had to try.
you have to, of course.
Well, thank you so much for your time today. Our listeners are going to love hearing from you. And now get back to finishing Warhead so we can all play it.
I thank you very much. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Have a good day. Bye-bye.
Thank you, you too.
While the PC Gaming Alliance were home washing their tights, the folks over at Stardock cooked up what they're calling the Gamer's Bill of Rights. No need to look it up, because Evan and I are going to read all 10 of them for you.
All right.
Okay,
So,
let's.
Houston?
Okay, excuse me. Okay. We, the gamers of the world, in order to ensure a more enjoyable experience, establish equality between players and publishers, and promote the general welfare of our industry, hereby call for the following. Number 1. Gamers shall have the right to return games that don't work with their computers for a full refund.
Number 2. Gamers have the right to demand that games be released in a finished state.
Number 3. Gamers shall have the right to expect meaningful updates after a game's release.
Number 4. Gamers shall have the right to demand that download managers and updaters not force themselves to run or be forced to load in order to play a game.
Number 5. Gamers shall have the right to expect that the minimum requirements for a game will mean that the game will adequately play on that computer.
Number 6. Gamers shall have the right to expect that games won't install hidden drivers or other potentially harmful software without their express consent.
Number 7. Gamers shall have the right to re-download the latest versions of the games they own at any time.
Number 8. Gamers shall have the right to not be treated as potential criminals by developers or publishers.
Number 9. Gamers shall have the right to demand that a single-player game not force them to be connected to the internet every time they wish to play.
Number 10. Gamers shall have the right that games which are installed to the hard drive shall not require a CD or DVD to remain in the drive to play.
What do you think? What do you think of the Bill of Rights? I can tell you that I'm pleased as punch with number 1. I think that's the foundation of any, you know, good business is some sort of guarantee.
Yeah. Because, you know, you gotta be willing to respect your customers and, you know, treat them like human beings if you actually want them to keep coming back.
Well, absolutely. I think the people who actually accept the returned game should have the right to call them noobs. But they, but they should take the game, yes.
And spit.
I mean, it's refreshing, though, too. I actually had a chance to speak to Brad Wardell, I think is his last name. Mm-hmm. He's the CEO of Stardock.
Correct.
At PAX. And they had a big poster of the Gamer's Bill of Rights, and you could sign it with this like quill ink pen they had there. And it was just it was refreshing to talk to him. I mean, Stardock's a relatively new company, and it's nice that they're not sitting back and waiting for Microsoft or anybody else to do their work for them. They're, you know, just pushing forward with momentum and trying to establish themselves as a platform holder and a platform protector, really. So it's great news for sure.
I thought it was a bit of a mixed bag overall. I like some of them are really specific and some of them are really vague. My favorite one, because this has been a pet peeve of mine for years, is the one about how the minimum specs should actually be playable on those specs. There should be an adequate experience. Because I've said for a long time that when you pick up a game, you should look at the recommended specs on the box and actually treat those like the minimum. Because so often the minimum spec, they lowball that to get you to play it. But if you actually try and play at those minimum specs, it's far from an adequate experience. So I like that one. But then there's one a little bit later on, which is just very, very vague, like PC gamers have the right not to be treated like criminals by publishers. And I get the overall intent, but that's too vague to really be very useful.
Well, yeah, I guess that's sort of their blanket anti-DRM, you know. Like,
But they also have like specific DRM points, so this one just kind of felt like it was making up the numbers or something. I think overall my issue, I mean, I don't really have an issue with it. I support it entirely. No, I think it's great. I think the problem with it is it's going to go the way of all these other Bill of Rights that we hear about all the time, like an air passenger Bill of Rights and a patient's Bill of Rights. Like, it's not going to have any teeth. I mean, it's a really great distillation of all the popular PC gaming, you know, pet peeves and talking points, and I think it's going to get people in the media, you know, interested. But whether or not, you know, I mean, what you actually need is an alliance of software publishers to get behind it and say, we're going to abide by this, and I don't think that's going to happen.
And in addition to that, we need gamers to, you know, hold publishers and people that distribute games online responsible for these things, you know, take it upon themselves to kind of indoctrinate publishers, I think, too. That
would help. What good does having gamers come up and, it's a nice little publicity site to have gamers come up and sign this thing with a quill, but let's have like the head of, you know, Games for Windows and the guys from Activision and EA come sign it. Then it would actually mean something.
Yeah,
for sure.
The only one I thought I could do away with was the number 10. Gamers shall have the right. The games which are installed to the hard drive should not require a CD, DVD to remain in the drive to play. I consider a game that doesn't require me to put in a disc, that's an additional value, but I don't think it should be, you know, considered a right. It's not a big deal. It's a very casual and easy way to prevent casual piracy, you know?
And how much of a headache is it really to have need to have the disc in
your
drive?
Not at all. But on the other hand, a service like, you know, Steam adds more value to me. It's really valuable to me that I don't have to carry discs around everywhere, and I can take my laptop anywhere in the world and still play my games. That I'll pay extra for. I just don't see it as like a right. Like, I should never have to put in a disc to play my game. I don't think that's a big deal.
But the other one that I thought was a really good point was the one about installing rootkits and all kinds of hidden files, because that's been a really pernicious development in the last couple of years.
And especially because if you don't want it, you know, and you don't even know about it until you've already installed the game, you know, it just seems like that should be illegal, much less, you know, part of a bill of gamers' rights, you know, that they can install anything they want on your computer without your knowledge. And especially if it destabilizes your system, as so many of these things do, you know, not cool. But I think the basis, the most basic one that should be, that's fundamental to the Bill of Rights, is the right to return games that don't work. You know, will people copy games and return them and try to rip stores off? Absolutely, it's going to happen. But on the other hand, so many more people will now feel confident about buying PC games, you know, because you don't have the confidence with PC games that you do with consoles. Knowing that you buy a console game, it's going to work, you know, and people, it's a risk. Every time you buy a game, you're going to think, is this going to work with my video card? Is it going to run adequately? And what happens?
Yeah, it's a double blow, because on the console side, as you say, Logan, you have that luxury of knowing that the game, you know, if you buy a 360 game, it's going to work, you know,
every single
a PC, because of the, you know, the different formats and standards and system requirements, it's always a bit, it's, you know, there's always, your heart is always a little bit in your throat, you know, every time you install a newly bought game for the first time. And then the other side of it is that, unlike a console game, the stores are much less likely to accept a return, because they worry that you're just borrowing it, pirating it somehow, and then bringing it back.
And then you have to worry, well, am I going to like the game at all? You know, I mean, there's so many tiers of doubt there that prevent people from getting into the games and buying more games.
Well, that's always a problem. I don't think stores should allow you to bring a game back just because you didn't like it.
But I just mean that it's an additional layer of doubt that keeps even more people away, you know, that all the burdens seem to be on the consumer here, you know?
Yeah, I mean, there are enough imponderables without having to also wonder, well, is it even going to work? Like, that should just be a given.
Yeah.
Do you guys have any experience of, do you know how many console gamers return their games? Or is that an easy thing to go about doing, or is that, like, sort of a hard thing to do, too?
I think you can bring it back within a certain, I don't remember, because I haven't done this in a while, you can bring it back within a certain period, but I think all you can get these days is store credit. They won't give you I don't know if they'll give you a cash refund anymore.
Mm-hmm. If you can get past that hurdle of, if this doesn't work, I'm screwed, then you've made a quantum leap, you know, in PC gaming, you know, and made the experience as easy for the consumer as it is with the consoles.
Well, what's it going to take to get there, though, Logan? Does there have to be some kind of, like, greater formalization of standards and system specs and things before we ever get to that point?
What needs to happen? Wow, geez, you're gonna have to convince publishers that, like, you know, for magazines, if you don't sell all the magazines on a newsstand, and this goes with paperback books as well, the vendor can just tear off the top cover of the magazines and send them back to the publisher, and the publisher refunds all the money for all the unsold magazines. So, you know, so the vendor doesn't have to worry about taking the hit for unsold copies. And publishers are going to maybe have to get used to the idea that, okay, if we get a certain number of returns for this game that didn't work, we're not going to let the vendor take the hit for that. We are going to have to take the hit for it. And that sort of, what's the expression? It forces them to you know, make better games and have better quality control, you know. Let's make sure that we don't make a game let's make sure we're realistic about our minimum and recommended requirements, so gamers don't take this and go, whoa, this game just does not work on my PC, because we're going to end up having to pay for it if it doesn't.
And
but that's a problem, though, isn't it, when you've got so many games that are constantly kind of reaching for the high bar. Like, it's like World of Warcraft, for example, a game which is kind of compromised on its, you know, on what it requires from the system in order to make it as mainstream as possible. Also, as a side effect, has the luxury of being one of the most compatible games. You very rarely hear about people having problems with World of Warcraft. It's very system friendly.
Yeah.
You know, one of the things that attracts people to PC gaming is games like Crysis that can do things beyond the reach of any console. But it's when you start getting to that high end that you also run into the most compatibility issues.
Well, let me throw this idea out there then. How about a system like one we've got in Steam already, where you've got a 2-day window to get a refund on a game you've just bought, and or maybe like a 3-hour window, a 6-hour window. What the hell? Something like that. You know what I mean? So you can try the game. You can see if it runs to your at a frame rate that meets your expectations and visual quality that meets your expectations. And if you don't like it, you just email, Steam or whatever service you're on and go, I'd like a refund. And they turn the game off remotely. How about something like that,
Seems pretty reasonable to me. I don't see why not.
And then maybe, and then publishers can also decide how long they want the window to be. Obviously Portal, you don't want a 6-hour window to demo that. 30 minutes should be adequate,
Well, it's interesting that you mentioned Steam, Logan, because maybe what will happen is if we do eventually get to a point where, physical media and bricks and mortar goes away and we are all buying our games off services like Steam, it will be easier to have that kind of system where can download the game and have that trial window. And if you can't get it working, then it's not quite the same thing as taking the disc away from the store and bringing it back, where who knows what you might have done with it. It seems like it's harder to pirate a game that you're downloading from a service where they can more easily control what your system is doing with it.
It's just
there's also a lot of problems that come up with gaming that aren't necessarily directly related to the system requirements. So like you have a top of the line system and you're ready to play. Maybe Crysis or something, and then there's just some piece of hardware that you have unique to your computer that, forces the game to, quit or something, and, is causing all these issues, and, I don't know. It seems that would be hard to deal with on a publisher's end if you were like, well, I'm trying to get it to work, I'm looking at forums, I only have, 30 minutes before they lock the game. I don't know, that might be a difficult issue to deal with.
Actually, you know what? You may be onto something right there, Andy, because what you just said is that, obviously it's difficult for publishers to support the incredible diversity of hardware in PC gaming.
Right.
So this policy may actually save them money, because gamers who are having a horrible time trying to get their games to work, rather than having to sit there and for hours trying to help them, they're just like, look, we're really sorry.
We'll just turn it off.
Exactly,
yeah.
That may actually save them money in the long run.
Yeah.
And then make them, when they go back to the drawing board for the next game, think, okay, look, we got 18% returns on this one. What can we do in this development cycle to get our return levels down below 5%?
Hmm.
It'll be a rocky start, but in the end, again, you get more sales, more confidence with your audience.
For
what
sure.
Would you say is the average, anecdotally, what is your experience of, of every 100 games that you install and run for the first time, what percentage of those games, just work flawlessly first time, as opposed to you having to spend some amount of time fiddling around with to get them working properly?
I'd say in the last year of games, maybe one or two out of maybe the 20 games I played, I've had to, you've had to sit in a forum and read about something that's going wrong with your drivers or something. So it's a low percentage, but it happens still.
From Andy's figure right there, where he said one or two out of 20, I would up that to 4 or 5, but with a very strong caveat that I constantly have new hardware and drivers in my system. So I realize I'm at the extreme.
Extreme.
So
I have found, though, weirdly, this isn't a game-related thing. It's just kind of another little peeve. Is that oftentimes, though, having the most up-to-date stuff can be counterproductive. I just downloaded Internet Explorer 8, and now I can't stream movies off Netflix anymore. Got to roll back.
You're absolutely right.
And sometimes the latest NVIDIA drivers don't work in certain games you want to play, which is always frustrating.
That's why I don't get bitter about it when things don't work, especially games, because I know I'm in there under the hood all the time, tweaking the OS, installing applications, uninstalling them constantly. So
but you're
I
one of those people, Logan, for whom that is part of the experience. That's not the price you pay for the experience. That's part of what you enjoy about it.
Exactly. And I love, I actually love going into the options and playing RPG with the options. I can tweak this down and I'll get a little few more frames per second, and but I want more smoothing, I want more anti-aliasing, that kind of thing. I love experimenting with different settings, so I'm not a big tech support burden, But like everybody else, I do get frustrated when things don't work right out of the box.
You just got to re-roll.
But there is one other thing I would add to. I would take out this business about gamers shall have the right to expect meaningful updates after a game's release. I think, no, just get it right the first time. And instead, give me the right to use my PC while this game is being installed. You know, get rid of that screen that you know that doesn't want to be minimized and the stupid music. Da, 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 da. You know, just minimize it, you know, and let me get on with my life. And
I actually like the way that some of those companies do those install experiences. Though Westwood used to do a really good job of that with the old CNC games, where it was almost like the part where, you know, how you're like at a theme park and you're in line for a ride, but like even being in line is like they're showing you videos and kind of getting you hyped up for the ride.
Yeah.
Like that's the kind of install experience that I like.
Yeah, so that's very old school, though, don't you think?
It's good old school.
It's refreshing. I mean, for Red Alert, it was like you were opening like your command console and seeing like all these statistics and interfaces and all the different units displayed as you're getting closer and closer. It just builds this context.
Yeah, it's getting you G'd up.
Yeah, anticipation for sure. It was great.
In the old days of 8-bit games, when games took a really long time to load from cassette tape, they tried to do a bunch of things to keep you amused, because obviously this is years before multitasking, and oftentimes they would download a very, very small little game first that you could actually play while you were waiting for the main thing to load, because you got to remember you had to do this, you know, every single time. You know, it's like, God, sometimes I feel like an old bastard, but like, kids these days don't know they're born. Imagine what it must have been like back in the old days of 8-bit, where every time you want to play the game, you basically have to install it.
Yeah.
And so, you know, they tried all kinds of different things to get you amused. They gave you little games to play, and I think I kind of like that. Like I said, I think the analogy about being in line at the theme park is a good one. I used to like, you know, being in line for the old Back to the Future ride, and they would show you all these videos, and you felt like you were walking through, you know, the set of the ride, and you were, by the time you got into the ride, you were all G'd up to play. And I think that's install experiences. If they can't be minimized for whatever reason because they're taking up too many processes, They can at least provide you some kind of experience that gets you into the world of the game rather than just looking at an install bar.
At the very least, like Indigo Prophecy had a little quiz, you know, like how many liters of blood are there in a human body? I thought that was kind of cool.
Yeah, just something to keep you amused. And it makes the time go quicker.
There was one on consoles recently that kind of had some attention in the press with Devil May Cry 3. It took like 25 minutes to install on PS3 because loading time's really long. And they basically had this... it was like a slideshow, basically. It was like last time on Devil May Cry, and kind of recounted the previous story elements. It was decent. It had some character art in there, so yeah.
That may end up being kind of the cutting edge of where this work gets done, because it's interesting. Consoles, there's a little bit of a shift going on there where, you know, people who have traditionally been console gamers, the idea of waiting for a game to install is a real culture shock for them. Like Devil May Cry 4, like you said, and GTA 4 have both had fairly long install times. And for console owners who are used to immediate, you know, being up and running, they're like, what the shit is this? And so I think, you know, particularly console development, those developers are having to mitigate that by giving them, you know, especially because console gamers, I think, probably have shorter attention spans. And they're not used to having to install things. Those developers are going to have to go all the more, you know, even further out to keep players amused.
Okay, well then we'll leave that. But can we please get rid of the intro screens from NVIDIA, from the developer, from the...
No, those are fun because you like
what? Every time.
Dun 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 dun.
Like some of the. They're okay if you can quit through, but some of them are really long and they force you to sit through them.
Yeah. Dude, I guess I'm just a fan of like ident marketing and design and stuff, so I kind of enjoy watching those little videos.
I know, I could tell. Dun, 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 dun.
But like, I think they're rad. They like, I don't know, it's like a gamer thing. Like, only gamers get that noise, you know, like, NVIDIA. Like, only gamers know what that is. It's kind of like our own little thing we got. Badass. Wow.
There are too many of these logos, though. You see it in movies as well. There was a piece in Variety just the other day about this, about movies now, where like literally it's more than a minute. You know, you're just sitting through logos before the film can actually begin, and I think people are getting a bit tired of that as well.
Let's hear it from readers and listeners. Do you have suggestions for the PC Gamer's Bill of Rights before it's ratified in... Oh, wait, well, it's going to be a while. But anyway, you know, you do have a voice, and the biggest voice is with your wallet. But I'm sure Stardock would love to hear from you. We certainly would, and you can send us your suggestions to the PCGamerPodcast@gmail.com address. Love to hear them. We'll share them with you, with all the other listeners next week.
XCOM games are on Steam. Really cool.
Now let's move on to PAX. Evan and Andy were lucky enough to have caught the scene over at PAX last week. Tell us about it.
Yeah, we had a lovely time there in Seattle last Friday through Sunday.
This is the Penny Arcade Expo, by the way. Sorry.
Yes. Big turnout. They were expecting around 40 or 50,000. They had about 59,000 people there, so it was pretty crowded, but very lively. Like, just the crowd itself was just very amiable. Everybody was treating each other with respect and whatnot. But as far as what we saw on display there, real quickly, some highlights. I got to play Pen Arcade Episode 2 a little bit. That was cool. They had Left 4 Dead was probably the hit of the show. Everybody was, it was right in the center. Tons of people there. It's probably like an hour wait for most people there. Yeah, it was excellent.
The Rock Band and New Guitar Hero booths were absolutely packed to the brim.
They were swamped as well, definitely. BioWare had Dragon Age Origins on display to the public, not playable, but they had a really nice demo that they showed there. Got to see Project Origin as well. A lot of cool cosplay, I guess.
looked like Fallout 3 had a cool booth with the trailers and everything. That looked cool.
Yeah.
Oh, definitely. And actually, on a personal note, we got to play, Andy and I and some other people that we play with online, and Norm from MaxPC, we got to play in a Team Fortress 2 tournament. There were 32 teams, and we got to third place. It was a blast. But otherwise, sort of some non-highlights that I had, I got to play, got to see Legendary, which is very derivative of Bioshock, unfortunately, just the way, like, it's a first-person game, sort of post-apocalyptic, and you open Pandora's box. It's that kind of situation, and there's the way the characters hand is, they have like a lightning charge ability. It looks identical to Bioshock. The lighting's the same. And there's a game called Damnation. I love Codemasters. I love what they're doing with racing games and Grid. I'm really fond of that. But if you look up Damnation, if you look up video of it, it's like identical to Gears of War. It's amazing. The design of the interface, the way there's sort of like blood splotches there, the cover system, even the way that the sniper tracer kind of hangs in the environment for a few seconds, it's identical and just very strange. But otherwise, everything else looked good. Probably most excited about, oh yeah, we got to see Fallout 3, obviously. They had a nice display there. They brought in like this old like 1950s camper that they were showing the game in. They had a sound system hooked up in. Yeah, it was really cool. They had a fridge in there, and they gave us Nuka-Cola.
Oh, nice.
An item in the game, and so that was very cool. Just real quickly, I was most surprised. I hadn't gotten to play Fallout 3 yet, and we played it for probably half an hour or so. Just with how much of the design from Oblivion Bethesda is transitioning into Fallout 3, it really felt like just a sci-fi Oblivion. I mean, I don't mean it in a bad way necessarily. There's a lot of new, unique things with the pausable combat and whatnot.
That sounds awesome to me.
Yeah, absolutely. But just the way like we started off and we didn't go on any story missions. We just wandered off to this elementary school and went in there, and there were some raiders that you could encounter and fight with, and just it felt so analogous to the way in Oblivion where you could just kind of go off the beaten path and explore and really stumble upon these encounters in dungeons and old fortresses with skeletons and stuff, and it just felt really similar. And there's a lot of other elements I could go into, but yeah, otherwise it was a great show. Really exhausting walking around and stuff, and convention, like, okay, the wait for Subway any time of the day was at least what, 45 minutes, Andy?
Yeah, bare minimum. It was that, I'd say closer to an hour.
Yeah, it was pretty ridiculous, but I guess they're gonna have another one in addition to this Seattle one, maybe next year in Boston, I guess.
I think they said 2010 for Boston.
Oh, 2010, okay, so next year probably be like 80,000 people, but that's okay.
How about you, Andy? Any low lights?
As far as lowlights, I was there, which I was actually kind of excited to just be as an expo goer. I didn't have a fancy press pass or anything, but just being able to...
Or highlights, you know, I'm just trying to be a downer.
Highlights, yeah. No, downer. Let's see, the drive was kind of long for me each day. No, I got to see actually MC Frontlot, which was a huge highlight because I'd never really known much about nerdcore rapping. And so I got to go to the screening of Nerdcore Rising. I'd suggest it to everybody listening. And I went to see MC Frontlot in concert, and it was easily the absolute highlight of the entire show for me. Because, like, I don't know, it's just it's fun. It's not, you know, parody or anything. It's definitely some pretty legitimate rap, and he's really, really good at what he does. But it's just really fun to, you know, have someone up there rapping about a Star Wars convention and have it actually sound really, really legitimate. So,
have you considered a career in nerdcore rap yourself?
Oh,
you have a nice sonorous voice. I don't see why you couldn't.
I'm working with the famous Captain Spaulding because I'm going to be laying down beats for him, and we're going to be going on tour across Australia because he's got a big following there.
Nice. Don't forget your
roots. Don't quote me on that.
Can I be your manager?
But, you know. Yes.
How long do you think it will be before there's like a truly legitimate mainstream nerdcore breakout hit? I guess Weird Al had that one that was pretty good.
Oh, White
Nerdy. That's true, yeah. Well, I think nerdcore or Weird Al is more parody than nerdcore. I mean, he's definitely a nerd, but, you know, the nerdcore rapping is more actually, you know, they're rapping about what they know.
Well, even though he was parodying an existing song, I guess, doesn't it still qualify? I mean, he was rapping, and it was about nerdy things, so...
No, actually, they addressed that in the movie Nerdcore Rising, and he definitely is just more a parody artist. You know, he takes a song that's already written and just changes the words, like, you know, with the Nirvana stuff and everything. You know, that's not completely stuff that he knows about. But he, you know, parodies it well.
Yeah.
But nerdcore is more rapping about what you know, whether it's, you know, Zork.
Emphasis on the core, basically, right?
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. So I'm not sure if I had to guess if there was an actual breakout hit. I'm not sure if it would ever happen because, like, there's a lot of people who are like, oh, I'm so nerdy because it's kind of fun to say. But, you know, they don't sit here and play World of Warcraft for 10 hours a day and they're, you know, not super into Team Fortress 2. They just own an iPod and think that they can hook it up to their computer and, you know a lot about technology and fit in.
Yeah, and I just touched on real quickly, just being at a convention is kind of like an epiphany. I don't know, not just because I haven't worked for PC Gamer that long. I did freelance before that. And just being in a place where you're surrounded by the people that are interested in the same thing you are and are invested in that, it's kind of reassuring just knowing that there's this big group of people that are so... I actually got to speak to a few readers and listeners of our magazine when I was in line or just walking around, and it's just really refreshing to know that there's this big group, you know, driving the industry that's invested and cares so much about it. It was really cool.
And just how nice everybody was to each other.
Oh my gosh,
matter.
Yeah.
Yeah, like, I mean, it didn't matter where I went. Or, you know, what kind of a nerd I was. You know, there's, like, tabletop game nerds. There's, you know, everything. And no matter where I went, you could just hang out and talk and have a good time about anything. And there was just, you know, no concerns.
Absolutely. And, like, when we were in the TF2 tournament, it's like after every round we'd, like, shake hands with people and we'd, like, relate our experiences. Like, oh, you were who had this call sign? You killed me that time? And it was everybody was just kind of on the same page. It was really refreshing. And if you ever thought about going to a gaming convention, we can definitely recommend PAX for sure.
Yeah, it's an A-plus experience.
Man. Just wait till you run into the developer whose game you gave a really bad review to.
you gotta
practice your dodge maneuver. Duck! Roll!
Yeah, and that's the other thing, actually. It's like you're constantly walking around. It's like a corporeal internet, basically. You're running into all these internet celebrities that you're... It's like, oh, there's Major Nelson, there's Felicia Day, there's, you know, whoever else, the mini bosses, and it's like, oh, okay,
they're just
wandering around. And Norm from MaxPC actually took a lot of pictures while he was there. I think he posted a gallery if anybody's interested in looking on.
I enjoyed that picture of him standing there reflecting on things, and there was a Team Fortress spy sneaking up on him from behind. I thought that was a cool one.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Where can people find the pictures?
It should be just...
Could it be linked from MaxPC?
Yeah, it's on the MaxPC website.
That's MaximumPC.com.
Yeah. Sorry, I listened to a lot of your guys' PAX breakdowns on the... You guys recorded a little podcast with, like, Havoc and some of our super listener extraordinaire boys who play on the FU server a lot. And
yeah,
that sounded like a lot of fun and definitely got me stoked for Showdown. I hope Showdown has like sort of the same feeling.
And
yeah, and like
we expect you to. Sure did last year.
Definitely want to go to PAX next year if I can swing it. We Havoc actually called in with an update with you guys. We want to play it right now.
Hey, what's up, folks? It's Havoc broadcasting from PAX. We were Spalding, Norm, Andy Salisbury here with Evan Kaboombitch, whole bunch of other folks. Day two, we just got done playing a little bit of Left 4 Dead. We're going to do a Rock Band tournament. We got knocked out of that early. Yesterday, we came in, what was number 3 overall? TF2. Rocking. These guys are representing Team FU. And we're sitting down now having a few brews, going to eat. And later on, we're going to party hard and do some more stuff. So, yeah. Sounds good. And hopefully talk to you soon. PCG!
So there you have it.
It's weird that it sounds exactly like the first recording from the moon. That's kind of haunting.
I like
wow.
It.
That must have been before... Well, Chris had his adios, motherfucker.
I wonder, were they really at PAX, huh? Were they really?
It was, yeah. That was when we were waiting outside a restaurant, getting ready to eat. Yeah. That was before our drinks, though, yes, for sure.
Yeah. They got a little out of control.
Yeah, Norm looked
Norm, like, took his shirt off and just started, like, running around and was like, yeah, video game. No, I'm kidding.
Yeah. I was actually really excited.
Stop the press.
Norm ordered this drink for us. He looked up the recipe. It's called an AMF. And he looked up the recipe on his iPhone, gave it to the waitress, and was like, make this. It has like 6 kinds of alcohol in it.
I know. That's called an adios motherfucker.
That would be
like it's like a Long Island iced tea, except it's blue.
Yeah.
I think that's illegal in Utah, adding that many liquors together.
I said that it should be called the Noah's Ark because it's like, bring me 2 of every liquor and put it in drink.
That's awesome.
I don't know.
Well, to my horror, I realized that I'd completely forgotten to introduce everybody, so let's just do that during our playlists. How about that? My name is Logan Decker. I'm your podcast host. And since we did the gaming laptop story the other month, I've still got the Asus 901 EPC. And I'm trying to figure out how to tweak it to get more performance out of it. I'm like this little miser with the Atom processor trying to go, come on, baby, you can give me a few more. But so one of the games I've installed is the original Fallout, and I'm playing that again. And... God, that's just as fun today as it was the first day it was released. It's a game you really can play over and over and over again, and you do get a different game every time. And other than that, I'm playing this other little game that I can't really talk about yet, but it rhymes with Moorhead. And we'll talk about that more next week. And joining us today, we also have Associate Editor Evan Lottie. What have you been playing this week?
Oh, gosh. I've been seeing a lot of stuff for preview coverage other than PAX. I did get to go up to Monolith while I was in Seattle. They're based in Kirkland, which is a little north of there, I think, and play Project Origin. I can't really talk about it, but other than I saw it, and it was nice. I had Eidos came in yesterday and showed us Batman Arkham Asylum and Battle Stations Pacific, the sequel to Battle Stations Midway. So that was cool. Otherwise, I've just been playing a ton of TF2, of course.
And we also have a former editor-in-chief, Gary Whitta. Gary, what have you been up to this week?
I just picked up Mercenaries 2, which is going to be new to me because I never played the original. But,
I didn't play the original either. But
I've heard a lot of good things about the original and also about the sequel. It's getting some good reviews, and it's just one of those games that even if it wasn't getting so many good reviews, I would still pick it up because... It just looks like the sort of thing that appeals to me. Like, it's a Grand Theft Auto type game, but a bit more sandboxy. And the main appeal is just the level of carnage. All the trailers and all the screenshots and all the footage that I've seen and all the reviews suggest that if you like to see things blowed up real good, this is the game for you. And that's pretty much me. So I'm going to look forward to... Hopefully, there is as much carnage and as much explodey things in the game as the previews have led me to believe. So I'm going to be getting into that.
For sure. I was actually Dan Stapleton. He's out right now, but he was playing it for review last week, and I kept looking over my shoulder to check it out. It was really cool, just the way like walls blow up dynamically and like fragment and stuff like that. It seems really neat for sure.
Yeah, I was playing co-op with Dan, and it is just co-op. As explodey as you think
There's
it
co-op?
Is. Oh yeah.
Oh, I'm sold.
Yeah, that sounds awesome.
Like, it was fantastic. And I loved Just Cause. When I was watching Dan play it, it looked a lot like Just Cause to me, except more explodier. So, you know, it's a natural fit for me. We also have podcast producer Andy Bauman. What have you been playing this week?
This week I've been playing Phoenix Wright, second Justice for All on my DS, and that's really the only game I've been able to get on. But I've got Assassin's Creed staring me in the face, ready to go. Hopefully going to play that tonight. And I'm looking forward to playing Stalker Clear Sky when it finally gets released.
Oh, yeah.
So, but I really like the way Phoenix Wright is just such a campy, amazing game. And it does remind me of old school PC adventure gaming in a way.
Mm-hmm.
So I figure...
You like that. You know what else I think you'd really like is the Harvey Birdman game that Capcom did, where they basically took...
Wait, they did a Harvey Birdman
engine
game?
And put it in the Harvey Birdman
PSP.
World.
It's on PSP, yeah.
You get
oh,
it on
wow.
PSP, and it's also on Wii. And PS2, I think. I got the Wii version. But it's exactly, because Capcom own it all, it's exactly a rip-off of their own property. They took 100% the Phoenix Wright game style and game design and just put it in the Harvey Birdman world.
That's ridiculous.
But it looks like the animation from the TV show. It doesn't look like a computer game version of it. It looks like kind of an interactive version of the show. And it's a lot of fun if you like that kind of game.
Yeah, it's a fun... Definitely an amazing game. Not much gameplay per se, but just good stories and fun trying to figure puzzles out, sort of, and in a way that's attorney-ish, you know, trying to solve
that's
cases.
The podcast
and such.
Word of the week, attorney-ish.
There you go.
We also have a former intern Andy. Andy, what have you been doing?
I have been, well, other than hanging out at PAX and enjoying the company of my fellow gamers, I've been really getting myself back into Team Fortress 2 ever since that tournament, because I'd forgotten just how fun it was, as odd as that sounds. I just hadn't played it for a while, and you know, had my time occupied with other stuff, so I'm really doing what I can to take time out to play my fair share of Team Fortress 2 on the FU server, and I've actually, like the other Andy, have picked up my DS as well, and
nice.
I've been playing a lot of Animal Crossing. Just as silly as it is, it's just fun to just hang out and, you know, buy people green furniture and stuff, I guess.
Ladies and gentlemen, there are countries where you're not allowed to ask questions of podcasters, and dissent is met with overwhelming and often lethal force. This is not one of them, so don't take your freedoms for granted. Send your comments and questions to us in MP3 format to PCGamerPodcast@gmail.com. That's PCGamerPodcast@gmail.com, or just call us toll-free at 877-404-1337 at extension 724 and record your question there with absolutely no fear of reprisal or being disappeared during your next match on our Team Fortress 2 server. You are, however, encouraged to register your endorsement of the official party line by subscribing to PC Gamer Magazine. Just head on over to www.gamesradar.com/PC. For the PC Gamer Podcast crew, this is Logan Decker saying thanks for joining us today, and we're looking forward to informing and entertaining you again next week.
I'm not sure, other than, you know, the obvious wait times that were...
Whoa.
That was weird. Is my mic sounding okay?
It's sounding like...
Sorry, that was me. That was my fault.
Oh. That's the thing that happened last week when Logan's was like, eaten by a zombie, by a zombie.
I discovered if I move my, the thing that connects my microphone to my USB port, it does that, so I'm just trying not to move it.
I hate that. They gotta fix that kind of... Yeah.
But it does make for cool...
It is kind of a neat effect.
Yeah.
I didn't turn into a zombie.
How about Salisbury?
Sorry?
Let's hear the preamble.
I.
You don't know the preamble to the United States Constitution?
No, I'm just clearing my.
Wow.
I'm just looking
it up on Wikipedia right now.
I have no idea what you're talking about. I kind of have this thing
a little distorty.
How about if I move it further away? Is that better?
No, that's perfect, right?
Yeah, that's good.
Alright, okay, I got my third thing.
Schoolhouse Rock?
We the people of the United States, in order to form a more union, establish this.
Late.
Your domestic tranquility provide for the common defense. Cited number one.
There's no emotion. Where's your emotion? I feel like you're just reading.
Exactly. You have to declare. Declare.
I'm back.
We the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare and security of the blessings of liberty
you're
to ourselves.
You're overcompensating.
Yeah. Come on.
That's totally going after the podcast.
I was trying to sound ye olde. Quick question
have
for you.
Have you played the Korg DS-10 synthesizer?
My God. Is that out in
awesome.
America yet?
It's technically not.
I saw it on the 1UP show. And it was just like two dudes making a song, full synthesizer, rocking the fuck out. And I was like, holy crap, I need this.
Amazing. Yeah.
So speaking of rocking out, how was Ratatat found?
Oh, dude, Ratatat owned my face. It was awesome.
Oh my goodness.
I bet they're coming.
A couple.
I bet they're on their way to California.
All right.
I know, I was really super jealous of hearing about your guys' PAX experience. I'm just like, that sounded fun.
It was so, like, I mean, I don't want to, like, rub it in or anything, but it was actually hands down the best weekend I've had in a while, just being in that environment. Because I live in such a small town. Mm-hmm. I have two friends that are, you know, I can count on being video game nerds. And the rest of the time, it just, like, you know, I'm on WoW.
Yeah, I only, out of all my friends, there's only, like, three of them were, like, video game nerds. So it's, like, getting that many people together is awesome.
Yeah, it was great. Devin, what were you going to say?
Yeah, I mean, it's, like, I hadn't met anybody other than Norm, and I hadn't even met Andy, and it's just like everybody wanted to spend time together, like go to events, wait in lines and stuff together. It was like we had this crew that we just roll with. It was awesome.